This podcast addresses environmental considerations in forensic interviewing, specifically third-party presence, reliability, self-disclosure, and various ethical implications related to practice. This specific podcast discusses key differences in the clinical versus research and forensic interviewing environment, favorable versus unfavorable interviewing environments, preserving the integrity of the forensic interview, as well as various ethical implications of the presence of third-party observers or participants at the interview. While certainly not a new phenomenon, third-party presence in forensic evaluations continues to be a topic of interest among various practitioners. Specifically, environmental considerations in forensic interviewing and evaluation have been a topic of discussion among various neuropsychological evaluators, psychologists, criminal investigators, and continue to be a topic of discussion among various state and federal level court systems. There is, however, a distinct lack of empirical research addressing environmental considerations in forensic interviewing. Some of the most detailed considerations and instructions regarding interviewing environments and third-party presence have been involved in child abuse cases where evaluators are interviewing children who have been the victims of child abuse. There has, however, been a variety of literature and editorials published in psychiatry and psychology journals discussing third-party presence, as well as the practitioners' opinions on how third-party presence may influence the outcome of the assessment. This podcast will specifically address environmental considerations in forensic interviewing as well as third-party presence in forensic evaluation, most specifically, how those types of evaluations can accommodate or fail to accommodate third-party observation. We will also briefly discuss the differences between clinical and forensic evaluations as well as their related purposes. Lastly, the podcast will review practitioners' aspirations as well as points of view regarding third-party observation and a review of literature regarding social facilitation, various ethical implications of third-party observation, as well as privacy and confidentiality concerns. In 1996, in the Journal of Psychiatry and Law, Dr. Robert Simon purported that a forensic psychiatric examination is conducted best in privacy. The title of his federal legal publication was Three is a Crowd, The Presence of Third Parties During Forensic Psychiatric Examinations. Simon addressed one of the most distinct and accurate aspects of the forensic evaluation is that in forensic evaluations, practitioners are independent within the evaluative context and seek to maintain privacy as much as possible. In interviewing various attorneys, Simon was able to conceptualize two good faith reasons why lawyers seek to be present during forensic evaluations. He first noted that there was a concern with providing an accurate record of the examination and that there needed to be a means to effectively challenge any misrepresentations or inaccuracies of the results at trial. He also addressed that lawyers seek to address limitations in questioning, specifically inappropriate subjects, methods, or procedures that could be administered during a forensic evaluation. Also of importance, and which will be discussed a bit later in this podcast, is the possible violation of tasks germane to the interview and the rapport that needs to be established between the examiner and the examinee in order to gather objective and reliable information. Some jurisdictions in the United States do allow attorneys to be present during forensic evaluations in both civil and criminal cases, though stipulation usually exists that they must not interfere with the conduct of the evaluation. In 2012, a Michigan workers' compensation magistrate restricted a plaintiff attorney from accompanying his client's forensic evaluation based on similar concerns brought forth by the defense. Simon indicates that regardless of the presence of third parties during the examination process, both parties should be agreeable to the presence of third-party observers. This implies that if there remains concerns or an opposition to having the evaluation supervised, additional facilitation and mediation may be warranted prior to the evaluation taking place. In Simon's article, a variety of case examples were provided that allows us to better conceptualize how certain situations can pose potential and ethical challenges for forensic evaluators under these circumstances. In one specific example, the author indicates that an attorney was allowed to be present during an examination of a client claiming a severe head injury. Since the attorney was unable to be present at the evaluation, she sent a nurse paralegal in her place. The paralegal never said a word during the examination. The paralegal was later offered as a witness to impeach the alleged improper conduct of the forensic psychiatrist who attended and examined the plaintiff. Another interesting concept brought forth by Simon is that the presence of a third party not working under the supervision of the evaluator could alter the confidentiality status of the evaluation. In formulating his opinion, Dr. Simon spoke with psychiatrists who voiced concerns regarding the attorney-client privilege, implying that the evaluation, should it not be helpful to the retaining attorney's case, may or may not ask for the report to be disclosed by the expert. As can be seen, any third-party presence could potentially jeopardize the protective status of the information and violate any potential work product provisions available under current case law. Dr. Simon lastly notes that the fact that an evaluation, which is court-ordered, does not necessarily mean that the confidentiality of the evaluation does not exist. One of the most common objectionable aspects of an attorney's presence during the forensic evaluation would be leading the examinee to answer certain questions a certain way. Interfering with the free flow of information, the presence could also alter the meaningfulness and the emergence of information, potentially disrupting or destroying any rapport needed between the examiner and the examinee to obtain reliable and valid information. Dr. Simon went as far to indicate that should any of these conditions exist, a psychiatric evaluation would be invalid. This too would apply to a variety of evaluative environments, including forensic rehabilitation. An important consideration prior to conducting a forensic evaluation where a third-party observer has been recommended is to ask oneself whether or not the presence of this third party enhances or inhibits the process and/or goals of the evaluation. Of significant importance is when attorneys are unable to be present for the evaluation and instruct the opposing expert to attend. In vocational rehabilitation, certified rehabilitation counselors and disability management specialists work hand-in-hand in helping individuals return to work. In forensic rehabilitation, these same professionals conduct a variety of independent evaluations that are used to assess vocational and earnings capacity, many times used in various administrative hearings and in civil litigation. When an attorney is unable to be present and the opposing expert attends the forensic evaluation, this can create an adversarial context that breeds distrust and tolerance among opposing experts. Depending on the training and professional preparation, forensic experts may use different methodologies or clinical procedures in conducting an evaluation, which may be perceived by the other party as being deviant or unprofessional. Dr. Simon notes that conflicting modes of evaluation does not imply that they are unethical or unjust in reaching objective conclusions. There are many biases associated with litigation, and stakeholders have invested interests in particular points of view. This author makes very clear that information will become jeopardized if the consultation room turns into a courtroom. The conclusion of this literature indicates that whenever possible, forensic evaluations need to be conducted in private, and while the majority of these evaluations are taken within adversarial and litigated contexts, it should be anticipated that third parties would likely be asked to attend. This does not, however, imply that they should or will be able to attend, and further consideration and consultation should be undertaken. Questions such as whether or not the presence of a third party would inhibit or enhance the goals of the evaluation should be considered. This literature indicates that if third parties are present at the examination, they should remain silent without interference as not to jeopardize the disclosure of information. So at this point, it's imperative that we understand the differences between a clinical and a forensic evaluation. Various authors and researchers such as Bonner and Chaffin, Silvosky and Steinmetz have provided useful information in determining the differences between forensic and clinical settings. First and foremost, clinical settings provide an environment to where the goal is to provide certain treatments or assessment of symptoms that are used in making various recommendations that have a therapeutic focus. The goal in forensic interviewing is to obtain information as reliable and as accurate as possible, and which has a fact-finding focus versus a therapeutic focus centered on objectivity and neutrality and avoiding biases. It is not uncommon in clinical interviewing that the counselor or expert forms a therapeutic or working alliance, voices support, and advocates for the client, which is expected. In forensic evaluations, the court serves as the client, where the evaluator is responsible for providing objective and unbiased information to aid the trier of fact in making various judicial decisions. Interviews in forensic environments are formal and restrictive, and confidentiality is restricted. Many times the competency and reliability of information posed by the client is questioned and investigated. In contrast, in clinical settings, traditional confidentiality exists, and various interviewing strategies can be used without any specific methodology. The competency of the client is not a concern, and validation of reported information may not be undertaken. The primary goal of the forensic interview is to gain facts, and is typically governed by judicial systems and rules of evidence. Of importance, the forensic interviewer must maintain a mutual objective stance with a goal of maintaining the most reliable and valid information. In the year 2000, the University of Oklahoma Health Services Center, under the grant from the United States Department of Justice, published an article on the differences between forensic interviews and clinical interviews. This particular publication addressed issues related to child abuse and neglect and in the interviewing environments associated with such. However, many of the same environmental concerns regarding information reliability and disclosure apply to all types of forensic settings. A variety of empirical research and literature was reviewed, and the authors recommended that the interview be conducted with a child only, having no caregivers, family, or family members present. It was found that the presence of family members during the interview can disrupt the interview process and may accidentally modify the information provided by the child. It appears that independent of the forensic evaluative setting, these types of considerations and concerns continue to be voiced by practitioners. An important concept related to forensic evaluation is that of self-disclosure. A historical literature review conducted by Cosby in 1973 addressed the parameters of self-disclosure within the interview environment. Cosby identified that basic parameters of self-disclosure as the breadth and or amount of information disclosed, the depth and intimacy of the information disclosed, and the duration of time spent describing each item of information. In the review of research, he noted that actual disclosure, intimacy, and duration of the disclosure appeared to be partially independent with a correlation of 0.42 between the variables, indicating a modest positive relationship between the two. An inverse relationship was identified between amount of disclosure and intimacy or depth of information disclosed, implying that individuals tend to disclose less about more intimately perceived topics, and this effect also appeared to hold consistent across various cultures. This was confirmed over a variety of research conducted between 1958 and 1979 by various researchers. Of interest, specifically when conducting forensic interviews, Levin and Gergen found that individuals tend to disclose more positive aspects of themselves when trying to be ingratiating than when trying to be honest. In conclusion, Cosby noted that self-disclosing behavior can be seen as the product of two opposing forces, one attempting to increase the disclosure, while the other operates to inhibit the disclosure. Bennett pointed out that the critical problem one faces is not how to keep secrets from one another, but how to facilitate the readiness to communicate. The balance requires rapport between the examiner and the examinee and could be compromised to varying degrees under third-party observation. In 2005, Brandon et al. Conducted a study titled Third-Party Observers, The Effect Size is Greater Than You Might Think. This literature review was published in the Journal of Forensic Neuropsychology and identified that third-party observers have been found to significantly impair neuropsychological test performance on measures such as attention, verbal memory, verbal fluency, and cognitive symptom validity. The findings indicated that an observer during a neuropsychological evaluation should be expected to have a clinically meaningful impact on the examinee's test performance, with memory measures being particularly vulnerable. These findings also imply that third-party presence during vocational testing could compromise results and lead to invalid results, or worse, invalid vocational opinions. In 1977, in the Journal of Counseling and Psychology, Holin and Slakew conducted a study to investigate the effect of reduced privacy in the counseling setting on client self-disclosure. This study created three environmental conditions. The first was a private setting where the interviewer and the subject were alone in the interview setting. The second introduced a third-party observer who entered the room shortly after the session began and remained throughout the duration of the interview. The third experimental condition was where a third-party observer invaded the interview and remained behind a 3-foot barrier wall partition, basically exposing the interview subject to a third party. A total of 74 volunteers, 22 of whom were male, 52 female, participated in the study. The results identified that self-disclosure was higher in the private condition than in either the invasion or spatial invasion conditions posed by the third-party presence. Interestingly, it was found that self-disclosure in the invasion condition, whereas the third-party observer remained present and visible in the room, was slightly higher than when the third-party observer hid behind a spatial divider. The authors indicated that the results of the study demonstrate that reduced privacy decreases client self-disclosure in a counseling setting. The results also reinforce that self-disclosure is under situational control, and discussions should be carried out with all parties of interest to preserve the integrity of the evaluation. Some of the most recent and empirical literature on third-party presence was conducted by Sheely, Kramer, and Pirelli in 2008. These authors conducted empirical research regarding third-party presence during criminal forensic evaluations, specifically psychologist opinions, attitudes, and practices. This article was published in the Profession Psychology, Research and Practice Journal in 2008. The authors indicated that this study represented the first formal attempt to assess forensic clinicians' attitudes, knowledge, and practice in this area. They noted concern for the impact of third-party observers was grounded in social psychology, with specific mention in social facilitation research, where previous research has identified that passive observers facilitate easy or well-learned task performance and inhibit complex or novel performance. Significant negative effects on tasks measuring delayed recall, attention, concentration, speed of information and processing, and verbal fluency. These were all noted among various studies. In additional research conducted by Constantino et al. In 2002 and 2005, it was determined that there was a negative impact on neuropsychological evaluations when audiotaped or videotaped. Also assessed in this particular research study were various motivations for third-party presence, which identified that attorneys often cited the Fifth and Sixth Amendments as grounds of being present during their clients' court-ordered criminal forensic evaluations. In 1973, the United States v. Ashe indicated that the right to counsel is only attached at stages of the criminal prosecution that involved the trial-like confrontation of the defendant. The U.S. Supreme Court in Estelle v. Smith in 1981 agreed with the lower court's opinion that the presence of an attorney during a forensic evaluation would have little benefit and could actually harm the evaluation process. There are at times, however, that it appears that attorney's presence could be practical on those rare occasions when the defendant is unwilling to participate without the presence of an attorney, although previous literature and research suggests that the attorney should be a silent observer rather than a participant in the evaluation. A particular study authored by Sheely in 2008 posed a variety of questions to 400 randomly sampled licensed psychologists who were members of the American Psychological Association. Examples of questions included: do you believe that a third-party presence might negatively affect the results of a criminal forensic evaluation? As well as, do you believe third-party presence might positively affect the results of a criminal forensic evaluation? 400 persons were randomly selected, however, only 160 responded. And of the 160 survey participants, 58% believed that a third-party presence might negatively affect the results. 33% of the sample were unsure. Only 4% disagreed that it would negatively affect the results of the evaluation. Conversely, 33% of those surveyed believed that the presence might positively affect the evaluation, and 38% were unsure. When assessing levels of agreement with third-party attitudinal statements, survey respondents were provided with a variety of statements as to whether they agreed or disagreed, or had no opinion. A total of 19 statements were reviewed by respondents. 84% of respondents agreed that the defendant attorneys may try to shape or limit the defendant's responses during a criminal forensic evaluation. 91% of those surveyed agreed that the presence of a criminal defendant's family member or significant other during the pretrial forensic evaluation may lead to different conclusions or interpretations than one might have obtained if the family member or significant other had not been present. 80% agreed that the presence of a criminal defendant's attorney during the pretrial forensic evaluation may lead to different conclusions and interpretations than one might have obtained if the attorney had not been present. 90% agreed that the presence of a third party during the pretrial forensic evaluation of a criminal defendant may interfere with the establishment of rapport between the defendant and the examiner. 76% agreed that third party presence during the criminal forensic evaluation alters the standardization of the forensic eval. Lastly, 72% disagreed that during pretrial forensic evaluations, criminal defendants have the right to a third-party member of their choice being present. The results of this attitudinal statement survey indicated that practitioners have a negative view to third-party presence in forensic evaluations, in that they can affect the standardization of the process and influence the validity and reliability of the results. The highlights of this particular study by Sheely et al. Indicate that most psychologists surveyed believe that third-party presence may have a negative impact on forensic evaluations, but were less sure about any positive effects. The research also identified that there were a significant amount of ethical and legal challenges to conducting research that could elicit the true effects of third-party presence in forensic evaluations. In fact, the presence of family members during criminal forensic evaluations was identified as more negative than attorney presence alone. From a more ethical and practical perspective, confidentiality status and the standardization of the evaluation appear to be jeopardized with third-party presence. 90% of psychologists agree that third-party presence interfered with rapport building, a key component to successful evaluation. It is also important to note that 3/4 surveyed believe that third-party presence was a threat to test security when used in a forensic evaluation setting. This would also apply to copyrighted methodologies, report formatting, and structured questionnaires. An article published in the British Journal of Psychiatry by Sanson, Fisher, and Martin regarding standardized interviews and psychiatry issues of reliability provides additional information regarding the means of data collection in forensic evaluations as well as components of reliability. While this literature review does not address forensic interviewing specifically, various topics such as the reliability of the interview administration, when reliability should be assessed, and the reactivity of reliability during the assessment process provides important information when assessing interview outcomes and their validity. As defined by Mitchell in 1979, an instrument or evaluation can be said to have used reliability when there are small errors in measurement and when there is stability or consistency among scores for individuals on trait characteristics or behavior in which is being assessed or evaluated. The literature reviewed identified that many of the types of evaluations in psychiatry, as would be expected in related occupations, are semi-structured in nature. This tends to result in various disagreements in the interview and administration and would unbearably be reflected in reliability assessment. Sanson, Fisher, and Martin noted that of the 17 studies reviewed, which presented reliability figures, only 8 studies had reliability assessed throughout the period of investigation. Research by Taplin and Reed in 1973 indicates that if observers note that reliability is being assessed, the observers apply the rating standards more stringently in an effort to achieve the required level of agreement. This implies that a third-party presence in evaluations could actually facilitate that evaluators ask more specific questions, become more focused in obtaining answers specific to their assessment, and therefore gather more reliable data used to formulate their opinions. In conclusion, the literature identified that reliability is not a constant feature of the interview instrument and should be monitored whenever possible. One way to monitor the reliability of semi-structured evaluations are to supplement the review of data with various records that can be provided either prior to or subsequent the evaluation. For additional information regarding ethical dilemmas involving third-party observation, please refer to the Journal of Forensic Neuropsychology, Volume 4, Year 2005, as well as the Handbook of Forensic Neuropsychology, which provides specific chapters on third-party information and forensic assessment. For additional information regarding this podcast or any other previous podcast, please feel free to contact us at 517-622-4878 or by email at anay@hfarehab.com. Transcripts of our podcast can be accessed on the educational podcast section of our webpage located at www.hfarehab.com.